They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. I love Mexico. I love the Mexican people. Two waiters came up to me tonight, "Mr. Trump, we love you." I said, "Where are you from?" "Mexico." I said, "That's great, I love you too." These countries aren't sending their finest, they're sending people that are like, got a lot of problems. Doesn't that make sense? I basically said this. We need to strengthen our borders. And they said, "I'm a racist." To get the cars and trucks and everything over here, let the illegals drive them in. They're coming in anyway.
Oh, I do great with Latino voters. I employ so many Latinos. I have so many people working for me.
It's common sense. They don't want these people, so they send them to the United States, because the United States is run by stupid people. Some are good, and some are rapists, and some are killers, and we don't even know what we're getting.
Welcome, welcome, world, to another episode of the APE, known as Ape Academy Podcast. I'm your host with the most, Mr. Chase H. Let me introduce myself as usual. If you don't know me, I am a history PhD student at the University of Houston, a U.S. Army combat vet, lover, of course, of all things Philadelphia sports, husband, and a father. I'm happy y'all could join us today. Today's episode, we're going to do a short kind of introduction of our next major topic that documents the history of racialized violence on the Texas-Mexican border. All right, this is a huge issue. The border crisis has been a hot button political topic since I can remember. All right, and it's really kind of hitting a climax in recent years, especially with, as you heard, President Trump's comments about Mexican immigrants crossing into America, all right? We are going to do a deep dive into the blood-soaked history of the disputed region called the Borderland, and we're going to attempt to link past violence with current racist rhetoric describing the crisis as a, quote, invasion. All right, we're going to do our housekeeping notes. As usual, please follow, rate, and review the podcast. If you follow, you will, of course, receive notifications when new episodes are streaming. All right, so when you're sitting around, you're watching your reality TV, you're watching your Netflix, and you hear that chime, that bing, you look down on your smartphone, you see that banner on the top, APE Academy streaming now, all right? That's how you know new podcasts are out. If you have a few spare minutes, please rate us. It'll really help us in the rankings, help see kind of our progress in comparison with our competitors. And if you have an ounce, just a little bit more time, if you can write us a review. I don't care if it's two words, "This sucks," or a paragraph, "This is awesome, I love what you guys do." It doesn't really matter. I look at every single review and I use it as something that I can kind of gauge my content off of, and a way to get better, right? A way to make improvements, because we want to give the audience what y'all want to hear. All right. Lastly, social media. Please follow us on social media. We're on Instagram at Ape Academy Podcast. That is my personal page as the host, and our official podcast page is a.p.e History Pod. All right. Lastly, TikTok at Ape Academy Pod. All right, that's all we got. Housekeeping's out of the way. Don't want to make it too long. All right, as usual, I'm going to put my sources in the show notes. It's going to be a short episode, so there won't be too many sources, but we got more on the way. All right, so we're talking about the history of racialized violence on the Texas-Mexico border. Specifically, we're talking about racial violence toward ethnic Mexicans, okay? So that's going to be the focus of our next podcast. All right, this one and our next one. One of the reasons why we decided to touch on this topic right now is because, you know, as everyone probably knows, the election is coming up in November, and illegal immigration and the border has always been a very polarizing topic. All right. And I kind of want to connect current events, current things that are going on in the world around us to history, right? There's a history for everything, all right? Every issue we see now, whether it be politics, economics, race relations, whatever, can be linked to the past. And we can actually learn from our mistakes if we understand where we came from. All right, so we're going to hop right in. As I said earlier, it's going to be a really good podcast, but a really short one, all right? So some of the worst racial violence in the U.S. took place along the southern border between Mexico and Texas from 1910 to 1920. More than 1,200 of the 1,900 miles of the border shared between the U.S. and Mexico are located along Texas boundary lines. The inhabitants of this vast region during the 19th century included land-owning families of Mexican descent who wielded significant economic and political power. Over time, though, an influx of Anglo settlers, i.e., American white settlers, land speculators, and developers, often utilizing shady or even illegal tactics, dispossessed the original owners of the land, all right? By hook or by crook, these settlers came into the Texas borderland region and they started to dispossess the original owners of the land. This is a story that has been repeated over and over again throughout history. When the Mexican Revolution began in 1910, as often is the case during any conflict, fear helped to increase racial tensions that were already simmering under the surface. Among those sent to control the area and make the border safe were the famous, heroic, right, Texas Rangers. The fantastic Bullock Museum exhibit entitled Life and Death on the Border, 1910 to 1920, nicely summarizes the Rangers' reputation. Quote, "The reputation of the Rangers as upstanding enforcers of the law has often been seen as beyond reproach. Assisted by the romanticism of the rough and heroic image of the Texas Ranger that first became popular in the 1930s and remains so into the present day." End quote. Yet, the Rangers were the culprits of much of the bloodshed as they were deployed as henchmen for powerful state and commercial interests. The historian Nicholas Villanueva writes that the Mexican victims of lynching and mob violence were categorized as enemy others, criminals, and bandits. These were, of course, false claims that were made by the actual perpetrators of all of these crimes. The murders committed by Texas civilians, armed posses, and law enforcement officers such as the Rangers were widely celebrated in communities with photographs, praised in local newspapers, and even encouraged by political power brokers. Quote, "The alleged criminals were guilty largely of one unifying crime, that is being Mexican." So let's talk about the Mexican Revolution. Let's set the stage for the next episode. All right. 100 years ago, well, over 100 years ago now, the Mexican Revolution severely damaged U.S.-Mexican diplomatic relations. Prior to the arrival of European conquistadors, the region we now know as Mexico was home to an advanced empire of fierce warriors known as the Aztecs. After a brutal campaign of colonialism and conquest in 1521, the most powerful people in Mexico were actually European-born Spaniards. 3 centuries later, in 1821, Mexico won its independence from Spain after a protracted conflict. This conflict, however, mostly benefited the blue bloods that were of Spanish heritage, right? The Spanish aristocracy, who were a small but powerful minority in Mexico. Fast forward to 1910, most Mexicans were mestizos, half indigenous and half Spanish. And these indigenous people again rose up in violent armed struggle known as the Mexican Revolution. On November 20th, 1910, Francisco Madero led a revolt against longtime President Porfirio Diaz after Diaz refused to resign from the presidency. Now, I'm going to slaughter some of these Spanish names. I've been working on my Spanish. That's going to be my language during my PhD program, but just bear with me. It is recognized as the first major political, social, and cultural revolution of the 20th century. The motives behind the uprising grew out of the belief that a few wealthy landowners could no longer continue the old traditions of Spanish colonial rule, a feudal system called La Encomienda. The Encomienda was a Spanish colonial system by which the crown attempted to define the status of the indigenous population. It was based on the practice of exacting tribute from Muslims and Jews during the Reconquista, or Reconquest, of Muslim Spain that began in the year 810. Even though the original intent of the system was to reduce the abuses of forced labor employed in the New World, in practice, it actually became a new form of enslavement, right? A form of neo-slavery, new slavery. As legally defined in 1503, an encomienda consisted of a grant by the crown to a conquistador, a soldier, an official, or others of a specified number of Indios, Native Americans, and later Filipinos, living in a particular area. The recipient of this royal grant, the encomiendo, was authorized to exact tribute from the Indios in gold or in labor, and was legally obligated to protect and instruct the natives in the Christian faith. The encomienda did not include a grant of land, but in practice, the receivers of the grant could seize control of the land inhabited by the natives and did not necessarily fulfill their obligations. This exploitative system needed to be replaced by a modern one in which those who performed the labor could actually get the benefit from the land that they worked. So, let me summarize what I just said right there. So, the encomiendas was a system, a feudal system that basically gave landowners, right, selected by the crown, a blank check, right, a mandate to pretty much do whatever they want and exploit the natives. They were given a specific number of natives that they could control, and they were required to provide them with tribute, i.e. money, some type of gift that was given on a regular basis, right? On a routine basis. It was just another form of colonialism and exploitation of the locals and the natural resources of the area. Without going into a full-length discussion of the Mexican Revolution, which could be an entire podcast series on its own, two prominent leaders emerged: Francisco Pancho Villa from the north of Mexico and Emilio Zapata from the south. The men demanded the ouster of Diaz, who had been in power since 1877, a term of 34 years. This led to the outbreak of civil war and the overthrow of the Diaz administration shortly thereafter. Hence, the peaceful coexistence of the two neighboring nations, the U.S. and Mexico, which took 60 years to develop following the end of the Mexican-American War in 1848, changed dramatically as revolutionary fighting intensified. U.S. and Mexico had been working really hard to strengthen their relationship up until this point. Unfortunately, the Mexican Revolution really kind of damaged the U.S.-Mexican relationship on a state level, because the violence began to spill over the border and start affecting Americans, Anglo settlers, and started really affecting business in the region. And we all know when the powers that be, when their business, when their money is threatened, things are going to go bad. Villanueva writes, quote, civilians from both nations moved from enmity to animosity. Violence skyrocketed in the borderlands, and U.S.-Mexico relations crumbled in its wake. Soon, the two nations found themselves on the brink of war. The revolution spilled over to the American side of the border in the form of refugees fleeing the war-torn nation where they came from. Sound familiar, right? That's what's happening right now. The violence escalated and the lynching of Mexican refugees by Anglo-Texans increased, contributing to the reputation of the 1910s as the bloodiest decade of racial and ethnic violence in the United States during the 20th century. Sadly, the lynching of ethnic Mexicans was not a new development. In the years following the 1848 Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, there were over 150 lynchings of ethnic Mexicans in the U.S. and its territories, a majority of which were blamed on property disputes. Cases were most prevalent in the states of Texas and California and the territories at the time, right? They're not territories obviously anymore, of Arizona and New Mexico. Lynchings declined between 1850 and 1910, but spiked again between 1910 to 1920. A, quote, pattern of vigilantism developed in southwestern communities as Anglo-Texans increasingly took their interpretation of the law into their own hands. White Texans argued that state and federal authorities failed to prevent Mexican rebels from looting their businesses and farms. Many believed that the defense of their homes and pursuit of justice fell well within their duties as men. Thus, they tended to respond harshly to any perceived threat to this sense of manhood. This all happened in the name of Texas and national pride, of course. In his book, The Lynching of Mexicans in the Texas Borderlands, Villanueva argues that ethnic and racial tension brought on by Mexican revolutionary fighting in the borderland made Anglo-Texans feel justified in their violent actions against Mexicans. Echoing the state of the border today, this argument reflects the sentiments of many on the far right of the political aisle. Many people feel justified calling the current border crisis as, labeling as, an invasion, in quotes, and a severe threat to national security. While maintaining a strong, secure border is a primary concern of any nation, and I truly believe that, I find that the racialized, militaristic language of many critics, particularly incendiary and potentially dangerous. Gotta be really careful what you say, because it could lead to some serious violence. And the clip I played earlier in the podcast was a pretty much a mashup of former President Trump talking about Mexicans and the border. And he said very disparaging, very racist things towards Mexicans and Mexican Americans in particular. A large majority of Mexican refugees today are fleeing their country due to violence, economic hardship, or simply the opportunity at a better life, as many did in 1910. Only in 2004 did reliable estimates on the number of Mexican lynching victims begin to emerge, most notably in the work of William Carrigan and Clive Webb, who show that at least 571 ethnic Mexicans were lynched in the United States between 1848 and 1928. Nearly 20% of these killings occurred during the 1910s. Allegations of murder was the most common justification given by white mobs for targeting both Mexicans and African Americans. The second most common justification was theft. This is in sharp contrast to African Americans, who were often accused of sexual crimes or breaking racialized sexual norms. Quote, unlike African American men, ethnic Mexican men were not generally viewed by Anglos as sexual predators. Anglo men perceived the shorter, smaller-framed Mexican as a distinctly effeminate race. Despite the popular assumptions that vigilantism in the 19th century occurred primarily in regions where law enforcement institutions lacked a strong structure and social influence, vigilantism was in fact practiced in places where the criminal justice system was very established and very strong. Violence that superseded judicial procedures regularly articulated popular distrust of the justice system or local frustration with the bureaucracy of criminal prosecutions. So put simply, a lot of this mob violence that occurred in the borderlands in the early 20th century was actually in the presence of a strong law enforcement apparatus. The mobs, the white mobs, the Anglo settlers were mad that prosecution wasn't fast enough. They felt that they had to take justice into their own hands. Lynch mobs commonly took prisoners from jail, even though courts would likely have sentenced them to death anyway. These vigilante actions, however, were sanctioned by the judicial system whenever local grand juries failed to indict or prosecute assailants who participated in mob violence. All right, so this is one of these ironies that the failure of the justice system to hold people accountable created an avalanche where the justice system would take effect, an event would happen, people would get indicted, the grand jury would refuse to prosecute them, and the cycle would occur again. So the justice system only partially worked, but it worked in the interest of the Anglo settlers. In addition to acts by mobs, state and local police committed extralegal acts of violence that are often overlooked in lynching statistics. When including acts of extralegal violence at the hands of the Texas Rangers and local police, the numbers of victims of racial violence in Texas soars. The violence on the Texas-Mexico border took many forms. Ethnic Mexicans were intimidated, tortured, and killed by hanging, shooting, burning, and beating. Nearly all of the known victims were adult men, though a few women and children suffered the same vicious wrath. What this violence nearly always shared was location. Death often occurred in the isolation of the rural Texas landscape. So, ethnic Mexicans were being slaughtered with impunity on the Texas borderland region, in the Texas-Mexico borderland region. All right, now we all know, well, actually, I'm not going to assume everyone knows. We know that African Americans suffered terribly at the hands of white mob violence in really all across the country, but particularly in the rural South, right? But what made the African-American experience a little different than the Mexican experience was that where the Mexicans were being killed, there was a strong legal system. There was a robust law enforcement body called the Texas Rangers who had a lot of power. In some of the rural regions in the South, where African Americans were being killed regularly, there really was no strong system of courts or law enforcement. It was just the guy next door, the local constable, the local justice of the peace, and pretty much a posse. So there's a little bit different, but both groups suffered terribly. All right. On the next episode, we're going to jump right into it. We're going to get into a case study of a few particularly gruesome and tragic incidents, but we're going to try to pull some information out of that to show how mob violence against ethnic Mexicans was actually encouraged by the system that was there to protect the very victims that suffered the most. So, join us, all right? everything we do on this podcast, all the history we discuss is going to be linked to the real world. I'm not going to talk about any history in a vacuum because history does not occur in a freaking vacuum. Thank you for joining us, guys. We're going to be back on Thursday with part two of this series. All right? Remember, please follow us on social media. We're on Instagram at Ape Academy Podcast, at a.p.e History Pod. We're on TikTok at Ape Academy Pod. And we are also going to be on YouTube soon. Visuals coming soon, all right? I've been saying that probably for 2 or 3 months, but it's on the way. Also, if you could rate, follow, and review us, we would appreciate it. It really helps us with audience feedback. Join us next time for another great episode. God bless y'all. Ape out.